My name is Brett Tolley. I'm a community organizer with the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance. We're based here in Gloucester. And I'm also from a four-generation fishing family. NAMA is a fisherman-led organization building a movement toward policy change and seafood market change for the benefit of the ocean and our fishing communities and those who depend on seafood. Just a bit about our work. One of the big issues that we tackle is the corporate takeover of our fisheries access. This is a major problem happening in New England, in the United States, and on a global level as well. There are not many organizations out there who are organizing around that issue. We feel like it's incredibly important. We're at a critical moment just in history where our fisheries are at a tipping point. We're on one side. We can protect and preserve the public aspect of fisheries access. It's for the people, of the people, by the people. Or it can tip the scale towards a private property model, the same way that we've seen industrial agriculture go. We draw a lot of parallels and collaboration with farming families and family farm organizations around the country as well to connect those dots, where we see the same experience that farming families have faced over the years is being mimicked in our fishing communities as well. So when we look out for allies and people to connect to this work, we have a lot of friends on the farming side and the new economy world as well. But when we look out and see who are the reporters who are covering these issues, there's not many. So it was a real breath of fresh air and a wave of inspiration for us when we connected to Lee Vandervoo when she first started this work on the book that for us really touched on the heart of why we do this work and what we do. So I won't get into more. That's, I think, the preface. I'll just read a more formal bio of Lee so you can get a sense of a bit of where she's coming from as well. Okay, so Lee is an independent journalist based in Portland, Oregon, focused on enterprise and investigative journalism. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, High Country News, The Atlantic, Slate, and others. She is the managing director of Investigate West, the Seattle and Portland-based nonprofit journalism studio. And so without any further ado, it's our honor to welcome and be here with Lee Vandervoo.
My mother has a very funny story. My mom is here about a certain recitation while I was a brownie, where I walked onto the stage and disappeared behind the podium of a. So Brett just did a really great job introducing the subject matter that I'm here to talk about. And thanks very much to the folks at NAMA for having me here and for Henry for having me here. Happy to talk a little more about the subject and about my book. So the background of how I got into this is very, fisheries is not my background. Like Brett said, I'm a career journalist. I spent 10 years in newspapers and became an independent journalist in 2009. I was freelancing and I got an assignment from High Country News, which is a magazine out in the West, to do a story about salmon on the Columbia River. And I did the story, and after I did the story, I was loudly complaining about how I was never going to do a story about fisheries again. I thought, this stuff is super boring. People don't relate to it. It's just about a big dust-up between who gets to catch what, and most general readers really can't relate to what's happening out on the water. Well, a friend of mine, we were in a bar. A lot of my stories start this way. We were in a bar. He said, you know, I'll bet you right now a beer that I can get you to do another story about fisheries. And he started telling me about how national policy in America was moving toward catch shares, which is a system I'll explain in a minute, but that essentially these issues were not just about who gets to catch what. They're about gentrification, if you will, on the seas, and they're about the rights of coastal communities like this one to be able to sustain their culture and their history and their livelihoods and their well-being by utilizing the natural resources that are closest to their to them, to their communities. And whether or not national policy was going to come in and start to prioritize market forces, special interests, and things that were cloaking themselves, honestly, in the sustainable seafood movement in order, you know, being prioritized over the communities themselves. It's about people's rights to be who they are, where they are, in a certain place in time in our society today, and to have our policy lift that up or to push it aside in favor of corporatization. And Niaz earlier and I, we were talking about this, and she likened what's happening on the oceans to what has happened in a lot of other systems. She could explain it much better than me, but she touched on education, banks, housing, lots of systems in America today that have, you know, just really overlooked the little guy. I think there, and Brett, of course, mentioned family farms. There's no place really, to me, where you see all this hit quite as hard as you see it on the sea. So I ended up getting an assignment to go do a story about the subject matter. I got an assignment to go to Alaska. I thought I'd come back with one story for an editor who I know. And I went there, and I came back with this embarrassment of riches and completely addicted to the material. That was 5.5 years ago. Between then and now, I had a fellowship to travel the United States. I've been to every federal catch-share program in the country. I've been to sea on some of these boats and four regions of the country. I've walked the docks pretty much in every catch share in America, and I can tell you that this is a policy that has not worked well. But there are really solid reasons for pushing some change in fisheries, and so I wanted to push myself really hard to understand those. I ended up spending a bunch of time with the founders of a brand called Gulf Wild in the southeast of the United States, who were working really hard to try to create the ultimate traceable seafood system. Just a word about catch shares before I read to you a little bit. But catch shares are a policy that essentially what they do is they take the pie that can be sliced, if you will, all the fish that can be caught in the ocean, they slice it up and they give away the access rights to those fish in ownership to individuals or corporations, whoever qualifies, in perpetuity. And in that, I think the hope was that these folks would become great stewards. You know, you give people an investment in the sea and they're going to fish well because they want there to be more fish later. What happened was that a lot of people became landlords. There was incredible downward pressure on workers. So you've got two sets of issues. You've got the folks who really did fulfill this vision of being great stewards. They are bringing us some of the really neat products that we're seeing in seafood today, and those are the Gulf Wild folks. Through their story, I was able to see a lot of innovation in the marketplace and why they were making a case for this policy. So half of my book follows them through creating this brand and explains what it was that they were trying to innovate. The other half travels around the U.S. and explores these communities and the ways in which that they were harmed. Deep consolidation in the industries, landlords, rental prices skyrocketing. Essentially, we've got people working on the seas now that are the new American sharecroppers, and they'll go to work and they'll pay 80% of everything they own to the person that owns the rights. You know, these are two very, very different outcomes. And so I'm going to read you a section from each part of the book, one from the Gulf Wild section, one from one of these other communities.
Can you spell the acronym, CATCHERS?
Oh, sure. Catch like a softball.
Oh, catch.
Yep. And share like...
And the other is
share.
Gulf,
G-U-L-F. Wild is the brand that's featured in the book.
Go ahead. Yeah.
These shares, are they areas or...
percentage of fish? What
percentage.
Percentage.
Yeah, it's a piece of the pie. So if you're, the argument is if you're being a really good steward, the pie gets bigger, so your piece gets bigger. That's the incentive. So hence, yeah, percentage. It's divided by fishery.
And who is selling these catch?
Well, initially they're given to folks for the first time by the government for free. Yeah.
Within the boundaries or beyond the boundaries?
Within the federal U.S., so within 200 miles of ocean, not the inshore portion that's controlled by the states, but out a little bit further, and yeah. They're given to the first generation, and then after that, they can be traded on markets. They can be sold. They can be leased. They're very much like a house. I can rent my house. I can lease it. I mean, and that was the bet, you know. Everybody was just going to, you know, give 100 people a house. Everybody's going to cut their grass, right? Like, that was the vision. And the vision is slumlords and a lot of people cutting their grass. So it's very, very mixed outcomes. Can I answer any other questions before we? They are like commodities. Yeah, I would say so. I would say so. They're transferable. Kind of like a little.
That's part of the gentrification that you're talking about. The change.
Yeah, indeed.
No longer controlled by the communities and the families that have been fishing for years and years.
Yeah, exactly. It's no longer controlled by necessarily by communities and families that have been fishing for years. It becomes controlled in the sense of, you know, you might see these folks first, the first generation of owners be people who have been there for a long time, but as people sell out, these properties consolidate, they get very, very, very expensive. So, you know, to run a boat in Alaska, for example, you're looking at $250,000 just to get started. Lots of young people, I mean, they'd rather buy a house, right? So you get to where the bar to get started is just so high that the properties tend to gravitate toward the, you know, the next deeper and deeper pocket. So we've certainly seen Wall Street interest start to move into this space, you know, big investment, large multinational fishing companies. But you see a lot of individual investors, too, investing in these properties the way somebody might buy a second home as a rental. You definitely see folks picking up fishing access and renting it out. Yeah?
If they're selling percentages of the fish, puts a premium on knowing what those numbers are.
Yes.
I think that's been one of the arguments.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly, it can be a bit of a gamble. I mean, the argument is that the number is only going to go up. So if you can get it now, hey, you're in early. But, you know, there are some fisheries where that hasn't proven true, and people have lost their shirts trying to make these investments, working people in a lot of cases. So I've seen that in the halibut industry where you've got very, very young people who borrowed money because they were told this is the smart thing to do. And they're buried in this debt, just buried in it. A lot like you might see, you know, people borrowing money to go to college, getting buried in that debt. I've seen it with young fishermen as well. They're borrowing to start their business, and they're getting buried.
Ultimately, who's making out in this?
Well, it seems to me that the properties are gravitating toward, you know, the next deeper pockets. And at the point where you start to have, like, multinational investment companies moving in and buying up these assets. I think there is an end game here for investors. I think a lot of these policies have been sold as investment tools. We talk about them in the policy arena and to consumers as sustainable seafood, but I have been to investment seminars where these are talked about as investment vehicles and where there are companies, very large companies, angling to control ownership so that they control the food supply. There's a lot of pricing control there. A lot of these policies have been pressed forward by the Environmental Defense Fund, which receives substantial funding from the founders of Walmart. And there's a clear connection between Walmart dollars and the way that this policy has taken off in the United States.
There could be.
Well, it depends on who you ask. I mean, there's a lot of people who really like to shop at Walmart, and they like that lower price, and there certainly is a guarantee of food supply, and that's what they're looking for. You know, other folks would say that they want those products maintained locally and not put into the global supply chain. And you know, are those the best paying jobs? Is that the most money and most dollars in the communities? I don't know. Maybe not. You know, I want to say that these policies are tied to, you know, putting really hard caps on the amount of fish that can come out of the ocean. And that is really a good thing. But it's something that federal law has required for many years, since 2006. So, you know, the environmental goals are certainly, they're noble, but there's better ways to get there, in my opinion.
Is that what you said?
Yes, there are other ways to get there. Yes?
Can you just speak for a second about the genesis of catch shares and who were the proponents of these ideas?
Well, these ideas go back to the 50s. The early proponents of them were folks who believed that the essential problem with fisheries was that there was no, that they weren't economically efficient. So a lot of these programs were designed by folks who believed that the best thing you could ever get from a natural resource was for it to make the most money for the least amount of labor. And so that's kind of at the core. They were tried in other parts of the world before they came here to the United States in the 90s. And they have been doing, you know, what you would imagine in terms of getting the highest dollar for the least amount of labor. So deep consolidation, bigger boats, bigger companies. But again, the community values are slipping. I'm going to go ahead and read a little bit. So this is from one of the Gulf Wild sections in the book. His whole financial life riding on the Falcon, he did what he had to. He took the small profit he made in his last season fishing snapper and bought a used longline spool, a metal contraption that looks like a giant bobbin in a cage, and he plopped it on the back of the Falcon so that he could go longlining. Tilefish and yellow-edged grouper, in fact, behemoths, and not something he had done before. But this is what the Derbies were doing. They were pushing fishermen from one fish to another so that they were not so much controlling the bloodshed on the seas as they were shifting it from fish to fish like a kind of roving hit mob. They were also pushing fishermen to try things that they didn't quite know how to do, and it was how so many of them were getting hurt. Buddy Gwinden had hardly fished with long lines before. His only other experience was with a few feet of trot lines on a lake. Now the spool on the back of the Falcon carried 6 miles of line. In sharp contrast with the trot lines, its breaking strength weighed as much as 2 tightrope-walking gorillas, about 700 or 800 pounds. And it was made from a single plastic fiber, a melted polymer that's been stuffed through a hole. At different grades and weights, it varies from sturdy wisps to thick whips and wraps around a hydraulic spool that reels it in and out without someone having to turn a crank or haul their arms into spaghetti. This particular filament, mono for short, was razor thin, and it laid around him that day in 1 mile sets of baited hooks that he and his crew deployed like seafloor fish carrots. Gwinden's ability to wrangle it was about parallel to his know-how in running trips like this, not good, in other words, so that he was floundering around the ocean on the hunt for a fish he hadn't chased before. The rest went down like this. John Best, the youthful deckhand, is sitting with a bucket of bait between his legs, and Gwinden is working over the starboard side in a little path behind the cabin, steering the boat by the wheel and running the hydraulics that turn the spool on the back of the boat. His grouchy but endearing first mate, Jim Carithers, is behind him, and Carithers was the best man at Gwinden's wedding. Carithers is taking the fish off the hooks as they come up the middle of the boat from stern to bow. When the empty line arrives, Gwinden takes the clips off it, metal wing dings that look like oversized diaper pins holding hooked filament. The job sounds like doing a lot of things, driving, hydraulics, pulling clips, but for anyone who has done it, it is more monotony than motion. Long lining is like factory work, Gwinden says. You just do the same thing over and over and over, which is why this particular brand of fishing is such hell on the hands and wrists, and why, over the life of such fishermen, pain crawls from the hands to the shoulders, marking time until it works its way across the back and down to the hips and knees. Now in his 60s, Gwinden says he wakes up in the morning not sure which part hurts most. He says this tongue-in-cheek in his way of dryly dropping jokes until it's not quite clear where the jokes end. This day in 1992, however, is no joke. Though Gwinden is in his physical prime, he's in a mood. He's behind his mental game hunting this fish, and minute by minute his temperament vacillates between euphoria at catching a few and doom at hauling long stretches of empty hooks. He is more accustomed to winning. It is this swath of sea that has been Gwynden's church from early days, worship a drive into sun-soaked water in the aid of a compass and a few well-placed windows. There's no GPS back then. High-growing coral was the thing you found by accident and never made the mistake of finding again. But in some ways, the fishing was easy. The oil rigs that stood in the Galveston Channel looming over the boats like scolding aunts marched into the sea for 150 miles plus, so that a fisherman could practically eyeball his way to the fishing grounds in the deep, cold water around the reefs. As a snapper fisherman, this is the place that Gwynden prays to, carefully cultivating his fishing spots with the aid of buoys in the arcane Loran Sea, the radio navigation system that was birthed by the military and adopted by fishers before GPS and waypoints made it so boats could drive and practically park themselves. But now the spool is turning, the monofilament is coming in, fish are coming off the hooks, hooks are coming off the line, the two-man crew is icing fish, baiting hooks, relief. But empty lines next bring worry. Worry about whether he can keep his house, feed his kids, clothe them, make it so his wife's sacrifice in quitting her job will be worth it. Then the mono gets stuck, gets caught somehow. Gwynden starts turning the boat in a circle, trying to shake it loose. He turns into the port side, letting the line drift under the boat, and then he turns it starboard, letting the line pull, trying to find the angle of the knot and set it free. Frustration plays its ugly role. He's anxious to reel it in and find fish on the line. If he cannot make it work with grouper, he cannot make it fishing, so he keeps turning the boat. He makes a full circle, but the knot won't budge. Happens, fishermen will tell you. But he wasn't a longline fisherman, and he didn't know. So he didn't shut the spool off, and then he did the thing more experience would have prevented. He leaned over the rail. The last thing he saw was that the knot had pulled tight, so tight that it was either going to snap or break the molding off the boat. He pulled his head back, but not fast enough. When the mono snapped, it pierced the skin on the right side of his nose, dug deep, and scraped down, cutting his upper lip in two. It took less than a second. When it bridged his mouth, sunk into his lower lip, then turned across his chin like a figure skater, the clock was still frozen. His hand flew to his face. Something bad had happened, but he couldn't tell what. When he turned to the crew, and blood poured out of him like rain, they could hardly bear to look. Skin dangled from his mouth and jaw like loose meat. He asked for a towel, someone passed it, and he could see that his crewmen were white. He pressed the towel in until the blood slowed, until the stinging turned to numbness, then staggered into the Falcon's cabin, into the mirror over the sink. I looked in the mirror and I thought, you better get your shit together because these guys ain't gonna help you. Gwynden's lips were cut badly and his cheek was cut too. He was 18 hours from the dock. On the bright side, he saw that he would live, but he had to put his face back on. At the time, he didn't know that you could glue a man back together. He'd never been injured like this fishing for snapper, so he went for a roll of duct tape behind the mirror instead, tearing it into strips. His upper lip was ground up bad. He pieced it together first, held it still with his fingers, and then taped it, wrapping the roll around his head to hold it still. His mustache was so ensnared the tape would have to be cut away later. It was not the most pressing concern. 18 hours from the dock, whatever position that was in when it stuck back together, that's where it was going to be, he said, and he still wanted to be good-looking, so he did his best. From a first aid kit under the sink, he found a wad of gauze and stuck a bunch of it behind the remains of his lower lip and cheek, where he found deep holes. He thought he had lost a few teeth, but found that they were there, even though he could not feel them. He pulled his lower lip together so that the flaps along his chin closed and then taped those, winding the roll around his head so that later a doctor would have to tear the tape out of the hair on the back of his head, too. About a half an hour passed before he'd finished. He had started thinking about his gear already, but by then the crew had wheeled the boat around and headed for land. Both Best and Carruthers were standing at the wheel, looking out the front window as if driving required four hands. Neither of them could turn around. Gwynden climbed into the bunk behind them and pressed a towel to his face. From underneath, he watched the radar as the boat edged closer to home. He tried to joke, but he couldn't talk much. When he did, the other two men got their color back, but it seemed to take them longer than it took him. He didn't make it home, but he made it to the hospital where he was stitched up by an on-call oncologist who complimented him on his taping skills. She gave him needles and thread and lidocaine that he would fortunately never have to use, and she told him firmly that he should not go back to see too much bacteria. Indeed, it would take 3 weeks before he could do much without the wound breaking open, and because his boys were young and rowdy and his own home was a hazard of potential collisions and ricochets, he went to live with a mother-in-law who was not at all fond of him looking, by his own description, like a monster. My head was swollen up, like, huge, especially the left side of my face was maybe 2 or 3 times the size it was supposed to be, and it made it go up my forehead, my ears, my neck. It was gross-looking. Still, when he walked out of the hospital, his wife rushing toward him, all he could think of was that gear in the water, $3,000 sitting in the sea. It was how I made my living, and I couldn't afford to replace it, he said. He had borrowed all he had, all he could for all he had, and though his stitched wound was like the crook of a rope ripe for barnacles, he was still the only one that knew how to haul that gear, however badly. So he went from the hospital to the Falcon, climbed back into the bunk, and fell deep asleep while the crew charted the return course. When they found the buoys, the lines, and the clips, Gwendon stepped out on the deck and hauled another 80 pounds of fish with the gear. Later, they sold it with the 800 pounds in the hold, caught before the medical detour, is worth $3.50 a pound. The crew got 50 cents of each. Gwendon got the rest for the ice and the fuel and the bait, for the boat's costs, and for the breadwinning. And luck finally on his side, no bacteria made a nest of his face. It went on like this for years, though, with long lining on the side. Gwendon kept fishing, and he fished until the pennies added up, and he bought a fish house so he could become a seafood buyer. Then he bought another, more boats. When cat shares became talk of the industry, there was a vote. He voted no. It was another change in a series of changes, most of which had turned out to be bad for him. When it passed, he panicked, and he prepared for the worst. He sold one of the 2 fish houses and a boat, and he got his bills under control. And it wasn't until the reorganization was over and cat shares were in place that he realized he'd come away owning access to a rough 5% of the red snapper in the Gulf of Mexico, his share based on historic catch, and he was one of the largest red snapper owners in America. So you can see from that passage why it was that people felt that we needed systems that controlled how we fished, with mechanisms other than just giving people, you know, a short amount of time to go fishing. Some folks argue that using cat shares allows people to take as much time as they need to accomplish the fishing, and certainly I think that's very reasonable to want to give fishermen more time on the sea so that accidents like this don't happen. Sir, in this era of slowing down the catch, people are much safer. They get hurt like this a lot less frequently. How am I doing on time? Okay. One more passage to you from a community that was hit really hard by catch shares, and this is kind of a counterpoint. This is a place called Cake. It's in Alaska. It's in southeast Alaska. In Cake, there is no bustle, no hype. It's the kind of place where civilization backs off rather than crowds in. Cell service is an open question. The internet is spotty. The nocturnal soundscape is but sea and eagles. People from outside this place can find the quiet so unsettling that the matron of the tribal lodge says some guests lie awake at night, stunned by the absence of noise, and look forward to leaving. Sometimes you can see it on their faces, she says. What am I doing here? In the daytime, there's airplane traffic sometimes, and a handful of drivers who get to where they're going quickly for lack of roads, but at speeds so slow that seatbelts go unused, and babies ride in the laps of bigger babies. The airport is a slightly large version of a bus stop. There is one taxi, and the culture of the town unfolds in such intimate circles that the chief experience of the outsider, and probably many insiders too, is that of the landscape, a thing that outsizes humans as the sustaining force of the place. The wind alone will remind you all day, every day, the salt pecking at your skin that you are at sea. The land underfoot is somewhat beside the point. Cake is a white man's take on Keeksquan, a Tlingit phrase indicating tribe. Tlingit itself means people of the tides, and these people are indeed of these tides. One look from a hilltop makes plain why their ancestors settled here thousands of years ago. Waterways surround the island's northern tip so that the original Cake village, arranged at the bottom of a hillside, is ensconced in mossy shore and barnacles from which the water unfurls like a kind of welcome mat. The Tlingit Nation once commanded the ocean behind it in canoes, its trade routes running south to California. What lies at this intersection of sea and land is nothing short of a kitchen made by gods. Salmon runs six streams to meet the sea here. Clams and mussels, gumboots and crab burrow in the tide pools and in the soft, shallow seafloor, ringing much of the town. Seaweed abounds, and the gulls that nest in it lay eggs as good as any chickens. All have been a food source for nearly as anybody, as long as anybody has been marking time here. So, too, has the bounty of Cakes Inland. In the forested hills of Kuprianov's interior, berries grow quite literally by the ton. Blueberries, salmon berries, gray currants and huckleberries, elderberries and thimbleberries, too. Skunk cabbage and wild rhubarb and fiddlehead ferns make for greens. Starchy vegetables come by way of spruce roots and potatoes. Moose and deer, ducks and porcupines all have been part of a subsistence diet that reaches back through time to underscore why the island's founders chose this place. Oral history describes a search for the perfect ecosystem. Cake's founders discovered it. Before white people came along and rearranged things, the culture of this place was a rhythm of sustenance and harvest. Food was society. The potlatches were the stuff of legend. Reverence for both was once strong enough to end wars between clans. Cake's people first harvested salmon through summer and stored the bounty of the fish for winter. They spent the dark months sustained by smoked salmon and salmon eggs dried and stored underground. When food ran low, it was halibut that replenished supplies in spring. The meat was light then and easiest to dry. In times past, halibut was not such easy prey. Today, the juvenile fish are oft dubbed chickens for their eerie resemblance to poultry, but centuries ago and even decades ago, halibut was the size of an average fifth grader and twice as strong. Tlingit people hooked this fish on a special hook designed to drown them underwater so they could not fight them in canoes. They carried spears, too, so they could stab the fish if they lacked the strength to hold them down from the rocks and kill them. These fish woke the village from winter with meals forged of protein and fats, halibut heads boiled in sea oil, halibut chowder, and halibut soup, halibut cheeks rolled in flour and fried, and there were other uses too. Halibut skins were used as bags. A fresh halibut could be sliced thin and applied to burns like a salve. That life isn't lost from this place, but Cake's last 157 years are a litany of religious occupation, persecution, and shaming that drove its culture underground. Even still, halibut, along with salmon, was a life force. Commercial fishing allowed the people of Cake to rise up again, and for a while, they captured their piece of the ocean economy. 35 boats and a portage in a cove put 4 to 5 crewmen to work aboard each one every season. It was a big number in a town of barely more than 600 people, but it was a brief respite. Save for salmon fishing, Cake is commercially cut off from the sea now. Most of the time, you don't feel the things that happen that are still happening to put this culture on the defense. But today is not that day. It's a cloudy evening, somber weather to accompany a somber ceremony. The first of the elders steps into the road of Cake's old town in regalia, his red cap waving against the backdrop of dusty roads and oceans. He drifts between the buildings, the weather-beaten boards washed smooth by wind and rain, an embroidered eagle wafting homage to people long gone and to the eagles that can congregate here by the dozen along with ravens. Cake is like this, its structures and roads so immersed in the landscape it has the look and feel of a washed-out watercolor. The white hair beneath this man's headpiece and the blue embroidery of his cape pop vividly as if he has arrived through some portal from somewhere else, somewhere technicolor. Soon there are more people. A woman with a tambourine drum, a man in a veteran's cap from the Korean War, 5 eagle feathers in the back, and a row of well-dressed children. They circle a narrow trench in the road where yesterday a backhoe unearthed the edges of a human femur and a skull and file along a skinny strip of land between the trench and the tan side of a building. The bones are covered now, an archaeologist having already pronounced them hundreds of years old, his involvement a great irritation to these people who would have preferred their ancestors stay buried in the first place. There used to be markers for these graves, totem poles called funeral poles. But after whites descended, courtesy of naval operations and a steady stream of church and government-sponsored meddling, the poles were removed. The ancestors were lost in the soil. So as the ceremony begins, the man in the cape describes how the bones will be mapped with GPS this time. Back before this person was laid in the earth, the people of Cake nailed a silver spike into a nearby boardwalk on a day in 1913 and agreed to cloister their culture to survive the unrelenting attentions of militaries, missionaries, and other brands of the self-righteous. It was a day that followed years of war, if you can call it that, with the U.S. Navy. What really happened was that naval ships started getting into people's business after the United States purchased Alaska from Russia in the 1860s, and when a Cake native was shot by a non-native sentry in Sitka in 1869, and two prospectors were killed in retribution, the Navy sent the USS Saginaw to Cake to settle things. Sailors shelled the town, torched the homes, burned the food stores, and while Cake's residents took to the hills, people spent the next winter starving and freezing to death. It took about 20 years for survivors to regroup, and by then, missionaries had arrived to tell them how to save themselves. What they said was, get civilized and govern yourselves. Become a legal town. Quit with your witchcraft. Burn your totem poles. Dig up your dead, burn your coffins, and move them somewhere where they will not cause disease. Banish the unsavory sorts. Swear off alcohol and fights and the people who indulge in them, and send your children to school. So on that day in 1913, the tribal elders buried a box somewhere near the spike, and in it, they said they placed their old ways. The symbolic end of their culture was far from a casual move. It was a civic crisis. But the decision by then was not to live with the rule and the religion of whites or Tlinkets. It was to live it all or die Tlinket. And because smallpox and other diseases brought by whites were killing them too, religiously speaking, Cake's people had started wondering whether they ought to be having some of what the whites were having. Maybe their culture was silly, they thought. Maybe they did need a new god, and fear made getting one easier. The echo of all that is still here. The drumbeat is steady and doleful. The mourners stand backs to the wall, wedged on the island of land between it and the trench. They sing. The songs are Tlinket. The bare skeleton in the soil, somehow intact after the assault of the backhoe, lays covered. The archaeologists found a layer of shells above it and declared it food waste, evidence of a few centuries between the time these bones were laid down and this day in late spring. The state requires such exams to be sure there's been no killing, as there was once in Cake quite famously a short time ago. But these remnants are of another era, a better one, and they clearly summon the heartbreak of the in-between. Most days this place has a lot of happiness, people so friendly that passing drivers standardly wave. But there is that reverberation of the time the silver spike drove hard into the boardwalk, and of the time Cake's culture was locked in a box. A lot of that culture has been lost since then, to the canneries that came next, to the timber industry that followed, to the contractors that still come and go, and to the television that came alongside all of that to tell people what it is they ought to want instead of what they had. When you look at the history, it seems that so much came at this place so fast, it's hard to parse what was forced on Cake from the path that people found on their own. But in the middle they built the harbor, and they took to the seas in ways they had not, and they fed themselves and they fed a cannery with salmon by the tens of thousands while hundreds of immigrant workers lived in dormitories there until the compound shuttered in 1977. When cannery begat cold storage, a fresh fish house, they fed that too. No more. When halibut was divided into catchers and handed out to those who had fished at Cake's, boat owners got a piece, but not much. Timber had come by then, so that recent fishing history didn't look like history at all, but like an interlude punctuated by a lot of wood. The pieces of the halibut harvest that were awarded, called individual fishing quotas or IFQs, were small. Then the pieces trickled away. The town's single fish buyer, the cold storage facility run by a succession of different operators, had been blinking on and off for years before it fluttered out in 2014. It was the only supplier of bait and fuel and ice, but owing to the fact that electricity on Cake is powered by diesel, it proved impossible to keep the cold storage running at a nauseating 63 cents a kilowatt. Energy prices had tripled in the 12 years before it shuttered, so that the bill ran as high as $80,000, sometimes $90,000 a month, and various entities tried to keep it up. They all failed. And they especially failed to compete with towns like Petersburg nearby that paid a lean cents lean 8 cents a kilowatt for power and zip products to lower 48 with daily jet service, while the same shipments from Cake took 2 weeks. Cat shares added a liquidity to the slowdown, and when a businessman came to Cake to run the cold storage but never paid the boats, those who lost tens of thousands that season sold their quota, their access to halibut, to get through winter. When an elder who drove the catch to Petersburg for a fee passed away, that cost spread itself again too, to the detriment of a few boats. Their owner sold as well. Quota was quick cash when the bills got higher, when people didn't see one coming. Some didn't realize that they wouldn't be able to buy it back again, or that when they tried, the quota would cost twice as much as they sold it for. And who could blame them? For thousands of years, there are people who lived off this land and these wilds, and it did not immediately register that the government had given that away. Thanks, you guys are very kind. I can answer any questions, any more questions. I know you guys had questions out front. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't have a question. I just like to say that's fabulous writing. Mm-hmm. Absolutely
fabulous. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I like that part. Yeah, interestingly, I mean, I had about a year to write the book, but I also had a job, and I did a lot of this travel to these places during that time because I wanted to get the best narratives. So a lot of the book was written like on airplanes and trains and boats, and really in a, I think a way that shows that it was immersive, which I feel happy about.
From what you studied, do you see a path forward that you would recommend?
Yeah, I just think, you know, if we're going to have these lease markets in the United States, I don't understand why they're being controlled by private individuals. You know, I think the United States, I looked this up last month, made something like $253 billion, million dollars off the lease of timber in the last year for which there were figures. I think it was 2015. And I think that same money, or near to it, is floating around in fisheries, but it's all landing in private hands. I think if we're going to have this system where we're going to lease access to go fishing, that the government should probably be taking, you know, the public's due back. This is indeed a public resource, and I think that would better control some of these downstream impacts that we're seeing in communities.
So by public resource, do you mean a smaller business? Does that...
Well, by public resource, I mean just that I think, you know, fish are a public resource, theoretically, you know,
right.
And that I think the economic gains that have been made on these systems should be returned to the public.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I have to say, first of all, beautiful writing. As someone in the fisheries business, a long-time fishery science and working with fishermen for 30 years, two things I'd like to ask you about, if you don't mind. One is that... the first comment I have for managers of the U.S. fisheries was that this individual felt that the solution to managing our U.S. fisheries was fewer fishermen. And I think we've seen that in some of the beginning of the CatShares programs, and you did a beautiful job of talking about the economics of it. And my two questions are, it seems like, I'm sure you've come across sort of the ethos of between NGOs that we've dealt with that think that the solution is to go down the path like National Wildlife Defense and others, is a solution to have sustainability, and for us it's been a challenge of actually combating misinformation and misrepresentation of fisheries science and the resources. That's one issue. And the second is, it's very important for writers like you that do a beautiful job of actually engaging and writing about our fisheries, because I think what we're up against as scientists in fisheries and working with fishermen and communities is that the let's call it the facts, the best portrayal of our fisheries and our fishermen and our seafood access in the U.S. is often misrepresented by myths and misinformation and organizations that have a lot of media clout, and that don't necessarily, you're not necessarily the person that gets the call from the New York editorial people for comment. So I'm sorry I'm going on, but you can sense the frustration.
Oh, I'm agreeing. I'm nodding in agreement.
Journalists and writers are engaged in actually uncovering the true nature of fisheries and fisheries science and everything behind it. And how do we, together, for journalists and fisheries scientists and our communities, demand the best information and better reporting on our fisheries? And we know that the lack of fisheries and science journalism is to blame, but your leadership is hugely important to us, and I hope you encourage your fellows to continue to write.
Yeah, I mean, I would say too, in your position, if you're dealing, you know, with someone who wants to write about these issues, I think the number one thing you should say to people is get yourself on the dock. I think we have a very landlocked press in the U.S., and, you know, my stepdad's a recreational fisherman. We have a boat in the family. It feels very normal to me to walk around the dock and talk to people. So when I picked up the subject matter, that was something that I did. And that helps people push past all the, you know, the double speak and the, you know, you mentioned these organizations with a lot of media clout. I mean, I think what they do really well is they handpick sort of representatives and they pair journalists up with these people. Journalists need to go find their own sources. We would never do this for any other policy, but they feel so helpless, you know, trying to interact with a more aquatic community that they're like, oh, great, thanks for the introduction, because they didn't know how to do this. I think, you know, the more we can encourage journalists when they're reporting on ocean issues to just get themselves on the dock and get themselves on the water, we get past a lot of this stuff. Yeah. I think the folks here at NAMA would probably give you a lot of ideas, but the one that they told me that I think is so helpful is to just know your fishermen. And it sounds hard, but it's like not as hard as it used to be. Like if you have a grocery store that you're really confident in, or you a fish market that you really like, if you have a dialogue with that person that sells you food, I think that's the very, you know, that's a good place to begin. It's not as hard as it sounds. I actually tried this in like our big out west. We have a big grocery chain called Fred Meyer, and I was like, man, am I saying something that's super elitist? I'm gonna go just to the big grocery chain and see if it works. And you know, it did. Like those folks were super knowledgeable. So I think just like building a little conversation in when you eat at restaurants, when you go to the grocery store is a nice first step. Try to know where your fish is coming from. Mm-hmm. If it's local, your chances of it being, you know, honest is a good thing. And if you want to get a little deeper into the social justice issues, there are CSA type things where you can buy direct from fishermen, know very much how they're running their operations and whether they're being fair to their workers. Those are more and more available to us all the time. I think there are some good ways. It is so hard to combat the misinformation, and I think all you can really do is talk to your friends. Hi.
From what I understand, though, if I'm buying from, let's say, the CSA,
mm-hmm.
and I do that for a lot of the meat and vegetables I get, but seafood, not so much, but even then you're saying these are your cat share people. So
well,
they may not be the family fishermen anymore. So I find that very frustrating.
Yeah,
to hear this.
I mean, a lot of people are regulated in catch shares, and if you're buying direct, you are gonna a lot of times be getting a catch share. There's really not a way to avoid it if you're gonna eat our domestic federal catch, but you can work with folks and ask them questions about are you going out and catching your fish, or are you leasing it to somebody who pays you. You know, are you, you know, do you treat your workers fairly? I think a lot of times these folks that do want to have a direct relationship with the consumer are really trying to run a different kind of business. I bet the NAMA folks could add a lot here if they wanted to. Well, you guys have all been really great. Thank you for having me.
I'll just give one plug before we give Lee applause. Just if any folks want to get more involved in this work or dive deeper in terms of activism or learn more about the values that we encourage people to think about when they buy locally caught seafood, totally visit our website, namanet.org. We got a great newsletter. We invite everyone to jump on, where we try and provide local action opportunities and some things to think about on a more regional level. So I would invite everyone to join our newsletter and visit our website.
Thank
no more applause for Lee.
Thank you.